an operation which in fact killed him. If Frunze had died in 1936 or 1937, the existence of such a rumor would have been perfectly natural. The significant thing is that it circulated at so early a date, at a time, that is, when Stalin had not given any precedence. Later Soviet books on Frunze have been notably touchy on the point. One biography elaborates at some length about doctors who said that an operation was really necessary, and who tended him through his last illness. This is a book by one of those military historians who have elsewhere been so frankly hostile to Stalin's acts against the generals. Unless, as is, of course, quite possible, other interventions took place on its publication, one tends to think that exculpation from such a source shows that Stalin is really believed not guilty by some of those who would be anxious to know. The most extraordinary thing is that the rumor was given public circulation. On its basis, Pilnyak, hitherto an almost entirely non-political writer, who had said that he knew nothing of politics and not being a communist could not write like one, produced his Tale of the Unextinguished Moon, subtitled Murder of the Army Commander. The hero, Gavrilov, is described as a well-known Red Army leader who returns to Moscow and orders and reads in the papers that he has come back for an operation. He has had stomach ulcers, but is now fully recovered. He goes to see a man described as the most important of the three who lead the party, who orders him to have the operation. The doctors examine him, and report that an operation is necessary, but afterwards in private conversation say that it is not. The operation is performed, and he dies of an overdose of chloroform. The story has a very sinister and gloomy tone. It was about to be printed in Novy Mir, but the issue was confiscated and the editors admitted in the following number that accepting it had been a mistake, and printed letters describing it as a malicious slander of our party. In the circumstances then prevailing, there were many copies circulating, and the story was printed in 1927 in Sofia. It is clear, indeed, that no one with any political sense would have written a story like the Tale of the Unextinguished Moon, and it seems likely that Pilnyak was put up to it by some friend more deeply involved in the struggles of the time. But no more was said about the matter for the moment. In 1929, Pilnyak was president of the All-Russian Union of Writers, a genuine association then resisting the maneuvers of RAP to enforce ideological and bureaucratic control of the writers. Mayakovsky's suicide in 1930 is now attributed, in part, to persecution by officials of RAP, in the face of opposition from all the best writers, and to a large degree from Maxim Gorky too. The RAPists failed in their task, and, as we saw, later lost favor and were themselves purged. But this did not save the non-RAP writers. Pilnyak's last effective work, Mahogany, served as a pretext for action against him. It was published in Germany as a preliminary to its coming out in Russia, then a common practice for copyright reasons. But it was then denounced as anti-Soviet and its publication abroad alleged to be a White Guard provocation. Pilnyak was now in great trouble and ready to submit to any ruling. Zamyatin, chairman of the Leningrad branch of the Writers' Union, was also under attack. His We, on which Orwell was to draw for 1984, had been published abroad in much the same circumstances as Pilnyak's Mahogany. He boldly demanded to be allowed to leave the country, refused to retract, and exposed the whole mechanism which literary persecution was already setting in motion, mild though its actions were compared with later developments. He said that the Moscow branch had passed its resolution without hearing any defense. First there was a condemnation and only then an investigation. I imagine that no court in the world has ever heard of such a procedure. He added that he could not belong to an organization that behaved like this and resigned his membership in the union. Finally, Maxim Gorky interceded for both Pilnyak and Zamyatin in Izvestia. We have got into the stupid habit of raising people up into high positions only to cast them down into the mud and the dust. I need not quote examples of this absurd and cruel treatment of people, because such examples are known to everybody. I am reminded of the way in which petty thieves were lynched in 1917-18. These dramas were generally the work of Obi Vitelli, obtuse Philistines, and one is reminded of them every time one sees with what delight people throw themselves onto a man who has made a mistake, in order to take his place. Pilnyak was allowed to settle down to write pro-Soviet literature, while Zamyatin's boldness was rewarded by permission to leave the country. Zamyatin was one of the few trained Marxists among Soviet writers, and on this account he had rejected Bolshevism, which was welcomed in a vague and romantic fashion by futurists like Mayakovsky, at a time, indeed, when the futurists of Italy were showing a similar romanticism toward the other new and dynamic movement, fascism. Pilnyak worked at a conformist novel, The Volga Flows into the Caspian Sea. Yazhov personally oversaw the production, listing 50-odd passages for amendment. Pilnyak became deeply depressed, and told Victor Serge, There isn't a single thinking adult in this country who hasn't thought that he might get shot. Equals, but he had the courage to intervene when Serge was arrested in 1933. In May 1937, he was attacked flatly for counter-revolutionary writing, and was arrested on October 28, 1937. It has now been stated in Moscow that he was shot in April 1938, and not at the later date given in reference books for the past 20 years. Tilde, the charge, or one of the charges, was of being a Japanese spy. He had actually visited Japan. His wife, the actress Kira Andronikova, mother of his three-year-old son, Boris, was sentenced to 8 years. Other prose writers of mark who perished include Panteleimon Romanov, author of Three Pairs of Silk Stockings, Artyom Vasily, and S. Rachikov, author of Roar China. Mikhail Koltsov, of Pravda, under suspicion as an agent of Lord Beaverbrook, was arrested on December 12, 1938. Sentenced by Ulrich on February 1, 1940 to 10 years without the right of correspondence, Tilde, he was shot at once. Others who were arrested but survived include Yuri Olesha and Ostap Vishnya. Vishnya, accused of planning to assassinate Postyshev and others, was released in 1943, and had to write deriding those abroad who had protested at his supposed liquidation. Poetry in the USSR was already a dangerous trade. Nikolai Gumilyov, Anna Akhmatova's former husband, had been shot as a counter-revolutionary, on Agranov's orders, in August 1921, the month which also saw the death of Alexander Blok, long past his brief enthusiasm for the Red Guard, from anemia due to malnutrition. Yesenin had committed suicide in 1925, and Mayakovsky in 1930. And now many of the best surviving poets in Russia were destroyed. The poet Vladimir Smirnsky, Andrei Skorobny, had been given 10 years as early as 1931, for participation in a group which had discussed politics almost entirely in relation to art. We do not know the charges against most of the poets who now went to their deaths. It seems that they were seldom accused of poetic crimes as such, though a case is reported of a young poetess arrested for writing a hymn to freedom which was construed as preparation for terrorism, and sentenced to 8 years in the Karaganda camps. There is no information about the eventual charges against such men as Nikolai Klyuev, Yesenin's disciple, whose best poem, his lament for his friend and teacher, sighs, "If I could only touch peace." He had already in the 1920s spent 3 days in the Leningrad Ogpu's steam room, and been released. He was again arrested in 1933 for Kulak agitation and counter-revolutionary verses and was exiled to Arctic Narum. Gorky managed to have him moved to the far more tolerable Tomsk, but he was eventually rearrested and is reported dying in a prison train and being buried at some Siberian halt. The poet Pavel Vasilyev is said to have defended Bukharin as a man of the highest nobility and the conscience of peasant Russia at the time of his denunciation at the Pyatakov trial, and to have damned the writers then signing the routine attacks on him as pornographic scrawls on the margins of Russian literature. On February 7, 1937, he left his wife, Elena, to go to a barbershop for a shave, accompanied by his host's son. Some minutes later the boy returned. "Lena, they've arrested Pavel." In all the prisons they answered alike, to the question, "Is there a Vasilyev amongst those arrested?" "No, Vasilyev, Pavel Nikolaevich, is not listed." Months went by. Some woman instructed her, "Prepare a parcel. He'll be in the place where they accept it." It was true, the parcel was accepted in one of the prisons. Moreover, they said that she could come again on 16th of July. On 16th of July the person on duty said, "He's been transferred to another place." And 20 years later, petitioning for her husband's posthumous rehabilitation, Elena Alexandrovna discovered that it was precisely on 16th of July that Pavel Vasilyev ceased to be the leading Georgian poet. Yashvili killed himself with a shotgun on July 22, 1937, registered as the result of the arrest of other Georgian literary figures, in particular his friend and equal the poet Tijan Tabids. In Boris Pasternak's letters to Georgian friends, we read of the Russian poet's brave and devoted attempts to help and consult Tabids's family after his disappearance, until his wife was finally informed of his execution, on December 16, 1937, when he was rehabilitated 17 years later. Many Armenian writers were shot. The poet Gergen Mari, who survived, tells how, "I was arrested at night on August 9, 1936. I was not surprised. A month previously the first secretary of the CC of the Armenian Communist Party, Agassi Kanzian, had tragically perished. The atmosphere in the House of Writers was very oppressive. He was in solitary confinement for many months without even being allowed out for exercise. It was not until 2 years after his arrest that he was tried. The military collegium of the Supreme Court of the Soviet Union is in session. I confess to terrorist acts, to the wish to separate Armenia from the Soviet Union and unite her to the imperialist camp. I intended to kill Beria. The court was a closed one, the trial lasted 3 minutes. I was condemned to 10 years deprivation of liberty. Once again Sanos, a jailer, formerly in the same orphanage as Mari, accompanies me. This time to the cell for sentenced prisoners. How many did you get? He asked in a whisper. 10 years. Thank God. You've got off lightly. 10 years, I repeat. For the third night running, when they've taken people out, they've shot them, he whispers. The 40 people in his cell included 2 architects, 3 writers, 4 engineers, and 1 people's commissar, all the rest were government employees and party workers. The opinion of the pessimists was that their prison sentences were just for the sake of form and that they would be shot in any case. However, in the autumn of 1938 we were crammed into lorries one night and, covered with tarpaulin like forbidden goods, were taken to the station. It was empty at the station, there was not a living soul, only troops. For 6 months, the prisoners lived in the Vologda city jail. Then they were taken to Krasnoyarsk, where a large army of prisoners composed of representatives of many of the peoples of the Soviet Union swarmed. Inhabitants of Central Asia stood out particularly in their bright national costumes. A medical examination determined who was to be sent on to Norilsk in the Arctic. It was then, for the second time in 3 years, that Mari managed to see himself in a mirror. He could hardly recognize himself. At the Siblog, Siberian prison camp, in Norilsk, he made friends with Egert, once a famous film actor. He was marched with 200 others to another camp, most of the 200 died later. Mari himself was there until 1947. He briefly describes 2 camp commandants, one hated intelligence wine and sent them to do the heaviest work, the other, who liked books, eased his lot a good deal. Released in 1947, Mari was not permitted to publish anything under his own name as his civic rights had not been restored, and in 1948 he was rearrested. This time, the cell was full of troops returning from German captivity. In 1948 and 1949, he was incarcerated in 9 prisons in 9 towns. He and his fellows were then classed as exiles for life. The Ukrainian creative intelligentsia, as we have seen, had been struck down on a vast scale every year since 1930. The Ukrainian poets perished in their majority for nationalist reasons, 16, starting with Lyazko in 1934, Arnema as executed or dying in camps between then and 1942, almost all at Solovetsk, though a few were in Kolyma. A group of neoclassicist poets, Mykola Zarev, Pavlo Filipovich, and others, was tried in Kiev in January 1936 for nationalism, terrorism, and espionage. One temporary survivor, the poet Mykola Dre Kamara, got a 5-year special board sentence on March 28, 1936, but seems to have died in camp in 1938 or 1939. Degree. There seems to have been another Ukrainian writer's case in October 1937. At any rate, A.S. Mikhailyuk is given as dying on 23rd of October and M.V. Semenko on October 24, 1937, a case perhaps associated with that of Ukrainian Politburo member V.I. Poreko, later to be denounced as a prominent fascist, shot on 25th of October. 2 more Ukrainian writers of note, M. G. Jogensen and G. 0. Kovalenko, perished on 27 and October 28, 1937, respectively, and 2 more, Slizarenko and P.P. Filipovich, on 3rd of November. Yet another concentration of Ukrainians is to be found on 12 to January 14, 1938, with the writer N. Filiansky and the old revolutionaries S.D. Vizoshenko and A.K. Serbachenko. And so it was in all the non-Russian republics. Their men of literature were almost automatically regarded as bourgeois nationalists, since, of course, they had been working in the national traditions of their own languages. In Belorussia, see here, most of the leading writers were shot. In Kazakhstan, the death dates of almost all the main figures are given as 1937 to 1939.7. The mean viciousness of such campaigns can be seen in speech after speech and periodical after periodical. It is at random that we quote from an attack in Revolyuzhnaya I Nationalnost on a Russian, Upper Mari dictionary by the alleged bourgeois nationalist S. R. Epan, who had omitted words like decolonization, opportunism, kolkhoznik, and the like, though in order to mask his wrecking policies included a few revolutionary words in a section at the end on new terms. He had also omitted the names of Marx, Lenin, Stalin, Molotov, and Voroshilov from his dictionary. This was all called counter-revolutionary. The Leningrad poet Nikolai Zablotsky, who exalted a starling song against the tambourines and kettle drums of history, was arrested on March 19, 1938 on a fake political accusation. A counter-revolutionary writers' organization had been uncovered in Leningrad, though its alleged leading members, Nikolai Tikhonov and Konstantin Fedinin, Moscow, were never arrested. Those implicated in what was also called the Perevol case, after the magazine in which they had collaborated, included the poets Benedikt Lifshitz and Boris Korneliev, who were shot in the autumn of 1938, Elena Tager, a short story writer, who spent 10 years in labor camp, and at least five others, all of whom were shot or died in camp. Connections were also made with poets elsewhere in the USSR, like the Georgian Tabits and D.I. Karms. Zabolotsky was interrogated for 4 days without a break, and tortured. One of the charges was that a poem of his was a satire on collectivization. On his return to his cell, he tried to barricade himself in and fought the warders who came for him. He was then beaten even more severely and taken in a state of collapse to the prison psychiatric hospital, where he was held for 2 weeks, first in a violent, then in a quiet ward. On recovery, he was literally pushed into a common cell designed for 12 or 15, which now held 70 or 80, and sometimes 100 prisoners. People could lie down only on their side, jammed tight against each other, and even then not all at once, but in two shifts. Such arrangements had been worked out by generations of prisoners, who had gradually passed on their acquired skills to newcomers. At night, the cell was pervaded by dumb terror at the screams as the hundreds of sergeants, lieutenants, and captains of state security, together with their assistants, got down to their routine tasks in the main Liteyny prison. Meanwhile, several Soviet writers are reported as coming to Zabolotsky's defense, and, together with his failure to confess, this seems to have led to the removal of his name from the list of major plotters. He was later transferred to a two-man cell in the Kresty, now inhabited by 10. In September or early October, he was sentenced by the special board to 8 years. On 8th of November, he was sent to Sverdlovsk, and on 5th of December started a 60-day train journey in a 40-man railway wagon, suffering the usual horrors, and ended up at Komsomolsk on the Amur, at hard labor in the notorious Bamlag. For part of the time, he is reported employed in the camp draftsman's office, which may have saved his life. He was released in 1944 and returned from exile in 1946. His sentence was annulled in 1951. However, his health had been undermined, and he was an invalid until his death 7 years later. The beautiful poet Marina Tsvetaeva had gone abroad soon after the revolution to join her husband, the literary critic Sergei Efron, who had fought in the White Army. She had written of the deadly days of October. In the 1930s, her husband was recruited by Soviet agents and joined a Soviet-supported movement for the return of émigrés to Russia. He was one of the first to be allowed back by the Soviet authorities, and he disappeared without trace soon after his arrival. Their daughter went from Paris to seek him and also disappeared. He had been executed, while the girl was to spend 16 years in prison camps. In 1939, Marina Tsvetaeva followed them. On August 31, 1941, worn out by long suffering, she committed suicide in the provincial town of Yelabug. Her scintillating poetry became widely known and circulated in manuscript. But in spite of its influence and popularity in literary circles, it was not to be published until 1957. Much of it had to wait longer, in particular a cycle of romantic lyrics connected with the tragedy of the White Army. Where are the swans? The swans have left. Where are the ravens? The ravens have stayed. Even in 1957, the publication of a short selection of her most harmless verses was soon called a gross political error. Another talent of the first rank, Ossip Mandelstam, was a sick man, with a nervous complaint. In 1934, he was called into the NKVD on an order signed by Yagoda himself, interrogated the whole night, and then sent to prison. He had written an epigram on Stalin. Pasternak is reported to have pleaded for him with Bukharin, a sign of Pasternak's naivety. It seems to have been now that Stalin rang up Pasternak and asked if Mandelstam was a good poet. Other writers went to Yanukitsa, still influential. At this time, when the terror had not got into its stride, such interventions may have been helpful. In any case, the poet was sentenced merely to 3 years exile at Sherdyne, a small town near Solikamsk, for conspiracy. He attempted suicide, and his wife appealed to the Central Committee. Mandelstam was transferred to Voronezh, a tolerable provincial town. He was able to return to Moscow in May 1937, but could not get permission to remain. On May 2, 1938 he was again arrested, taken to the Butyrka, and sentenced by the special board to 5 years forced labor in the Far East on August 2, 1938. Sent off by train on 9th of September, He arrived on 13th of October at the Vtoryarychka transit camp, from which prisoners were sent on to Kalyma. But he seems to have become half-demented, and was rejected from the transports. In his calmer moments, he sometimes recited poetry to his fellow prisoners, and once he was told that a line of his had been scratched on the wall of a death cell at the Lefortovo, "Am I real and will death really come?" When he heard this, he cheered up and for some days was much calmer. He suffered from the cold in his tattered leather coat, and seems to have got little food, dying, apparently of hunger, on December 26, 1938.7 he had written of his times. "But your spine has been smashed. My beautiful, pitiful era." And with an inane smile. "You look back, cruel and weak. Like a beast that has once been supple, at the tracks of your own paws." As with other citizens in all these arrests, the blind chance of objective characteristics prevailed. In December 1937, so Ehrenberg tells us, his son-in-law Boris Lapin tried to account for various arrests of intellectuals. Pilnyak has been to Japan, Tretyakov often met foreign writers, Pavel Vasilyev drank and talked too much, Bruno Jasienski was a Pole. Artyom Vasily had at one time been a member of the Perevol literary group, the wife of the painter Shukayev was acquainted with the nephew of Gogo Baridze. Writers sometimes intervened for their colleagues, occasionally with partial or eventual success. Tikhonov, Kaverin, Zashenko, Lozinsky, Tyanova, Shlavsky, and Shikovsky are named as doing so for Zabolotsky, Vygotsky, and others. But there were denouncers as well as victims, cowards and bullies as well as brave men in the literary world, as elsewhere. When Pasternak was refusing to sign the author's circular applauding the killing of the generals only to escape because the organizers added his name anyway, Yakov Ellsberg, the author of several books about Herzen, Shedrin, and others, who had formerly been Kamenev's secretary, now embarked on a course of deletion to remove the taint of this association, denouncing his former rap associates and others. Another, N. V. Lesyachevsky, denounced Zabolotsky, Lifshitz, Kamilov, and the other Leningraders. He was still alive and was feebly defending himself in 1988. During the thaw of 1962, the Moscow Writers' Organization managed to secure the expulsion of Ellsberg on a charge of having informed in the 1930s. The equally notorious case of Lesyachevsky was raised, then shelved. But when the organization fell briefly into the hands of a liberal leadership at the end of that year, the members voted once more to reopen the case, again abortively. Tilde such men lasted, indeed, while an honest Stalinist like Fedayev, who had tried to save some of his political enemies, committed suicide in 1956 on the exposure of his patron. Besides mere police spies, there were men who had simply sold out to Stalin, like Alexei Tolstoy, who wrote that Dostoevsky's Stavrogin was a typical potential Trotskyite and made a career as a regime hack. There were others who just accepted the killing of their colleagues. Surkov remarked long after the rehabilitations, "I have seen my friends, writers, disappear before my eyes, but at the time I believed it necessary, demanded by the revolution." In fact, the whole cultural world was under attack. Plots were discovered everywhere, for example, among the staff of the Hermitage Museum. The public arts suffered almost equally. The composer N.S.C. Eliev had been a friend of Tukhachevsky, and when he was arrested even the NKVD men were astonished to find that he had not yet taken down a picture of the late marshal. The conductor E. Mikolajce was shot in 1937. Many actors are reported in the camps, such as Shirin, sent to labor camp for saying, "Don't feed us Soviet straw, let's play the classics." Registered well-known actresses like Zero Shcherbinskaya, an ex-wife of Pilnyak, and Z. Smirnova followed them. Actresses and ballerinas are frequently mentioned in the camp literature. A typical arrest was under Article 58, Section 6, of a ballerina who attended a dinner arranged by foreign admirers. The celebrated Natalia Sots, creator of the Moscow Children's Theater, had been Tukhachevsky's wife, and was arrested in 1937 and sent to Rybinsk camp. She is reported there at several dates in the 1940s, but survived and was eventually released. But the greatest victim in the theater was Vsevolod Meyerhold. At the beginning of 1938, a short decree announced the liquidation of the Meyerhold Theater as alien to Soviet art. It added that the question of Meyerhold's further work in the theater was being studied. On June 15, 1939, Meyerhold was invited to make a public self-criticism at a meeting of producers presided over by Vyshinsky, himself, as the artist Yuri Annenkov remarks, a well-known producer of dramas of a certain type. Meyerhold retracted, but also, in one account, counterattacked. "The pitiful and wretched thing that pretends to the title of the theater of socialist realism has nothing in common with art. People in the arts searched, erred, and frequently stumbled and turned aside, but they really created, sometimes badly and sometimes splendidly. Where once there were the best theaters in the world, now, by your leave, everything is gloomily well-regulated, averagely arithmetical, stupefying, and murderous in its lack of talent. Is that your aim? If it is, oh, you have done something monstrous. In hunting down formalism, you have eliminated art. Trademark. Meyerhold was arrested a few days later. He was severely tortured, and wrote in an appeal to Vyshinsky that fortunately the interrogator Rodos had only broken his left arm so that he could still use a pen. Rodos, he added, had also urinated in his mouth. He was shot on February 2, 1940. His wife, the actress Zina Ida Rake, who had formerly been married to Yesenin, was found dead in their flat after his arrest, with, reportedly, her eyes cut out and 17 knife wounds. Only documents were missing, and there was no police investigation. Her death was thought of by prisoners to be intended as a general threat to wives. Meyerhold's theater had predeceased him. The disappearance of anyone led also to the disappearance, or reassignment, of his artifacts. On the arrest of the sculptor Krakow, all his works disappeared from the galleries. When A.N. Tupolev was arrested, the A.N.T. types of plane were rechristened. One prisoner reports a physicist who had with four collaborators completed a paper and lectured on it at the Academy of Sciences. The paper appeared in the scientific journals under the name of the two collaborators who had not been arrested. Tilda unorthodox works simply vanished into the files of the NKVD, where any that have not been destroyed still lie, with Gorky's last notebooks and Marina Tsvetaeva's last poems. Nor have we dealt with the more general effect of actions such as those described in reducing what had been a lively culture to a terrified level of almost unrelieved conformism. We have only been able to give a few illustrations of the way in which the purge hit the creative minds of Russia, half a dozen stories and a handful of names, including the greatest in the country. A Georgian paper in the Khrushchev era asked rhetorically, how many eminent writers, poets, artists, scholars and engineers perished in Georgia, repressed illegally, subjected to torture, exiled or shot. The same might be said of the USSR as a whole, where, as a more recent Soviet article puts it, there came about a tragic, unthinkable annihilation of culture, science, the best part of the intelligentsia. The few cases we have spoken of, and briefly, must stand for a holocaust of the things of the spirit. In the labor camps. No one who has not sat in prison knows what the state is like. 11. Tolstoy. The fate of the prisoner who had the good fortune to escape being taken to the execution cellars was to be dispatched to a corrective labor camp. The corrective labor codex defines three types of camp. 1. Factory and agricultural colonies where people deprived of freedom are trained and disciplined. Article 33, 2. Camps for mass work, which includes those in distant regions for class dangerous elements requiring a more severe regime. Article 34, 3. Punitive camps for the strict isolation of those previously detained in other colonies and underscore showing persistent insubordination. Article 35, the first category was mainly for very minor offenses against factory discipline, and for petty thieves. All sentenced under Article 58 or by the special board went initially to Category 2. The labor camp was one of the pillars of Stalin's whole system. Concealment of its nature from the West was one of his most extraordinary triumphs. For the evidence on the camps was, by the late 1940s, overwhelming and detailed. Thousands of former inmates had reached the West, and their wholly consistent stories were supported by a good deal of documentation, such as the many labor camp forms and letters reproduced in David J. Dallin and Boris I. Nikolaevsky's Forced Labor in Soviet Russia and, indeed, by the Corrective Labor Codex of the RSFSR, produced with much effect by the British delegation to the United Nations in 1949. Yet it was possible for Western intellectuals to disbelieve this material, and to join in Soviet-sponsored campaigns condemning all who revealed it as slanderers. And, indeed, there had long been an alternative Soviet story. There were, it is true, corrective labor establishments of a highly beneficent type. Their operations could be seen in such works as Pogodin's play The Aristocrats, which showed how prisoners were reclaimed at labor on the White Sea Canal and elsewhere. Pogodin represents bandits, thieves, and even wrecker engineers being reformed by labor. A regenerated engineer, now working enthusiastically at a project, has his old mother visit him. The kindly camp chief puts his car at her disposal, and she is delighted at her son's healthy physical appearance. "How beautifully you have re-educated me," a thief remarks, while another sings, "I am reborn, I want to live and sing." And much of the hostile evidence came from people who had been unjustly imprisoned in camps, and who had come to oppose the Stalin regime. They were, therefore, anti-Soviet, and purveyors of anti-Soviet propaganda. By this system, no evidence whatever of any facts unpalatable to Stalin could ever be admissible. As Bertrand Russell wrote of a labor camp book. The book ends with letters from eminent communists saying that no such camps exist. Those who write these letters and those fellow travelers who allow themselves to believe them share responsibility for the almost unbelievable horrors which are being inflicted upon millions of wretched men and women, slowly done to death by hard labor and starvation in the Arctic cold. Fellow travelers who refuse to believe the evidence of books such as Mr. Herling's are necessarily people devoid of humanity, for if they had any humanity they would not merely dismiss the evidence, but would take some trouble to look into it. Plus, as Russell truly remarks, it was millions who suffered. And here we have a point on which admissions only began to appear in the Soviet media in 1987 to 1989. While the publications in Khrushchev's time of such books as One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich and of various memoirs by former camp inmates amounted to an acknowledgement that the long-disputed evidence produced in the West was accurate through and through, this applied to the nature of the camp system, not, or not explicitly, to its extent. What many people of goodwill found hard to believe was less the existence of the system, in all its unpleasantness, than the numbers of prisoners alleged to be detained in them. When figures like 10 million were mentioned, it was an almost instinctive feeling that this did not accord with common sense, with normal experience. Nor, of course, did it. But, then, the reality of Stalin's activities was often disbelieved because they seemed to be unbelievable. His whole style consisted of doing what had previously been thought morally or physically inconceivable. Even so, it is difficult not to reject the larger figures out of hand as obviously exaggerated, and a very definite effort has to be made when we consider the evidence. This is multifarious, but inexact, and estimates have ranged from about 5 million upward. I am inclined to accept a figure of about 7 million purges in the camps in 1938. This cannot, in any case, be very far wrong. A detailed list of camp groups covering 35 clusters was given as early as 1937. A cluster usually included about 200 camps of around 1,200 inmates each. In 1945, on the basis of reports from Poles allowed to leave under the Soviet-Polish Treaty, a far more comprehensive account was given, together with a map, showing 38 administration clusters and groups, including 8 under Dalstroy, the Far Eastern Construction Trust. In 1948, Dalin and Nikolaevsky, on the basis of careful research, were able to list and describe the operations of 125 camps or camp clusters, mentioning that a number of others had been reported but not wholly confirmed. Like the other mechanisms from which Stalin constructed the purge, the labor camps were no new invention. With a few exceptions, our major accounts of labor camp life come from intellectuals who were sent to them from 1935, 1936 on. For the victims of the Azov terror included a higher proportion of urban, and of foreign, intellectuals than had the repressions of earlier years. As a result, we are inclined to think of the system as arising, or passing through an enormous quantitative or qualitative change, at the beginning of the Great Purge proper. There are, indeed, a few accounts by intellectuals from the earlier period, for example, Professor Chernyavin, and these differ a little from later ones. But on the whole, those who suffered in the first half of the 1930s were mainly peasants, who were less inclined to write books about their experiences, even though an equivalent proportion of them ended up in Western Europe as a result of the captures and migrations of the war. There is one important exception. When Viktor Kravchenko sued Les Lettres Françaises in 1949 for having declared his book I Chose Freedom a fake, many otherwise unforthcoming refugees in the West sent in affidavits of experiences of theirs which confirmed his story, and a number of these were peasants who had been in camps from as early as 1930. Their accounts, and earlier ones, make it clear that the system already existed in much the same form, if with fewer inmates, at this earlier stage. Brutalities are described, indeed, which for a time became less common in the mid-1930s. This probably signifies the automatic hostility of the NKVD cadres to those whom they were able to think of as a genuinely hostile class element, kulaks. At the same time, the tradition of the Russian Vlast, of straightforward beating for the clods of peasants, compared with a certain restraint toward the intelligentsia who might have influential friends and relations, still prevailed. Later on, of course, the latter class became, if anything, the target of yet greater extremes of brutality. But up to 1936, preferential treatment of political prisoners could still be claimed even by imprisoned Trotskyites, a category later to be marked out for specially vicious treatment. Camps seem to have been in existence as early as mid-1918, but the decrees legalizing them were passed in September 1918 and April 1919.7 The first true death camp seems to have been at Kolmogory, near Archangel, in 1921. A list of 65 concentration camps administered in 1922 by the main administration of forced labor is given in the directory and address book All Russia of 1923. This administration was merged in October 1922 with the corrective labor section of the Commissariat of Justice, and the whole brought under the NKVD as the main administration of places of detention. The first great camps were in the Solovetsky monasteries in the far north. Here, in Tsarist times, the monks of the oldest tradition of isolation from the world had withstood a siege from 1668 to 1676, defending their faith and the old belief against the reformism of the time. When the camps were set up, some of the old monks were retained for a time to teach the convicts how to operate the fisheries. They were later liquidated for sabotage. At the Solovetsky camps, health conditions were very bad. Epidemics reduced the population from 14,000 to 8,000 in 1929 and 1930. In general, these were bad times in all the camps springing up around the White Sea. The average lifespan in them between 1929 and 1934 did not exceed 1 or 2 years. This was almost always due to corruption and inefficiency among the jailers. The remedy was a conventional one. The GPU Commission would come down from Moscow and shoot half the administration, after which convict life returned to its normal horror. The original Solovetsky camp of special designation was changed in 1936 into a prison of special designation, and in 1939 the surviving prisoners were transferred by sea to Norilsk and Dudenin. The statute on corrective labor camps which governed the later period was adopted on April 7, 1930. The camps took their modern form at a time of vast expansion of the network. The most careful estimates of the camp population over the pre-Yazhov period run as follows. In 1928, 30,000. In 1930, over 600,000. In 1931 and 1932, a total of nearly 2 million in places of detention can be estimated from figures given for the allotment per prisoner of newspapers, and a Moscow scholar recently estimates that of over 15 million decolokized in the collectivization of 1930 to 1932, 1 million of the males of working age were sent directly to labor camps. In 1933 to 1935, Western estimates run mainly at the 5 million level, 70% of them peasants, and in 1935 to 1937, a little higher. But recent Soviet analysis suggests that, omitting deportees held in NKVD special settlements, the true figure may be lower, in the 2 to 4 million range. A Soviet textbook of the 1930s gives the maximum numbers at forced labor, Katorga, in Tsarist times as 32,000, in 1912, and the maximum total of all prisoners as 183,949. To the camps. This established system awaited the new intake. After sentence, the prisoners were crammed into Black Marias, of a type originally produced before the revolution. They had then been designed for 7 persons, but by narrowing the cellular partitions to a minimum, now took 28. Then, usually at night, they were loaded into the railway wagons taking them to their destination, either cattle wagons which had carried 12 horses or 48 men in the Tsarist wars and now held up to 100 prisoners, or the specially made Stolypin trucks, named after the Tsarist minister, though, as a Soviet writer says, why were these appalling narrow penal wagons called Stolypin trucks? They were of quite recent origin, which often held 20 to 30 people in 6-man compartments. These journeys to the camps might last months. For example, one prisoner describes a 47-day railway journey from Leningrad to Vladivostok. Such trips are sometimes described as worse than the camps themselves. The crowded goods wagons were practically unheated in the winter and unbearably hot in the summer. Inadequate food and drinking water and sanitary arrangements caused great suffering and a high death rate. A foreign communist complains of spending 6 weeks in a ship's hold, on one of the widest rivers in the world, with only 7 fluid ounces of drinking water a day. The trained guards, from the so-called convoy troops of the NKVD, were particularly brutal and negligent. During transport to the camps, the NKVD's regulation mania was not even formally observed when it came, for example, to rations. Sometimes there was nothing to drink the ration from. Often rations gradually got smaller and smaller, and the guards started failing to distribute them at all. Even the water to be provided was often forgotten for a day or two. A Soviet woman writer complains of the suffering caused by the provision of only 1 mug of water a day for all purposes on the long run from Moscow to Vladivostok. A Pole who collated the accounts of his countrymen deported in 1939 and 1940 remarks. It seems almost impossible for any human being, when not experiencing any particular sensations of anger or vindictiveness and when not in danger of thereby being deprived of it himself, persistently to refuse to hand in a bucket of water to 50 or 60 human beings shut in under such conditions. It is a fact that these men did refuse to do so, and could keep up this attitude throughout journeys lasting 4, 5 and 6 weeks. They were whole days of 24 hours when not a drop of anything to drink passed into the cars. There were periods even of 36 hours. Equals 3,326. The writer adds that in examining many hundreds of accounts, he has noted one case of a guard passing in an extra bucket, and five others of the doors being open for 10 minutes or so to relieve the feeder of the cars. Of the doctors or medical orderlies attached to each train, he found a few cases of a little more than blank indifference to particular children, and two records of decided kindness. The brutalization Buckhorn had noted in the party had reached down and everywhere reinforced a more archaic brutality. These train journeys were highly debilitating. A Soviet writer, later rehabilitated, describes a party of men being marched from Vladivostok transit camp to the embarkation point for Magadan immediately after coming off the train, without food. After several had collapsed and died, the remainder refused to go on, whereupon the guards panicked, started kicking the corpses, and shot a number of others. There is an interesting post-war account in the British Medical Journal of a medical examination of 24 women, former inhabitants of East Prussia, who had just escaped to Western Germany after returning to the Eastern Zone from Soviet labor camps. On their way to the latter, they had been packed about 80 to a truck, and they lived on bread and a spoonful of sugar a day. But the worst deprivation was the lack of water. It was estimated that about 40 to 50 in one transport of 2,000 women died en route. In one of the camps described, it was estimated that about half the women died in the first 8 or 9 months, mostly from intestinal diseases. It was usual for political prisoners to be robbed almost at once of their most valued possessions, such as warm clothing and good footwear, either on the journey or immediately on arrival at camp. This was done quite openly under the eyes of the guards. The old criminal underworld of Tsarist Russia, which since the time of troubles had developed as an extraordinary milieu with its own dialect and its own law, had been greatly reinforced, and its character much modified, by the tumults of the civil war and the famine of the early 1920s. Already then, the bezprizorni, the homeless orphan children assembling in gangs and living by their wits, had become a problem. Collectivization and other social experiments disrupted millions more families and provided large reinforcements to these now maturing criminals. The percentage of criminals was around 10-15%, but the majority of these were of the petty embezzler type, rather than IRCAs proper, who were seldom more than around 5% of a camp total. In some camps, indeed, there were none or almost none, particularly the more severe camps like the one described in Solzhenitsyn's One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, where almost all prisoners were in under Article 58, as interpreted by the Special Board. In other camps, their rule, which led to the slow murder of many politicals at night in the barracks when guards did not dare to interfere, was the norm. By 1940, the NKVD was often more fully in control, permitting only, in mixed camps such as Kargopol, regular rape hunts. Even these were largely suppressed in 1941. But later, a considerable relapse seems to have taken place. And in no case was there any serious interference with ordinary robbery and beating up. Soviet sources as long ago as the 1960s confirmed all this. General Gorbatov relates. While we were in the Sea of Okhotsk, misfortune befell me. Early in the morning, when I was lying half awake as many of us did, two trusties came up to me and dragged away my boots which I was using as a pillow. One of them hit me hard on the chest and then on the head and said with a leer, "Look at him, sells me his boots days ago, pockets the cash, and then refuses to hand them over." Off they went with their loot, laughing for all they were worth and only stopping to beat me up again when, out of sheer despair, I followed them and asked for the boots back. The other trustees watched, roaring with laughter. "Let him have it. Quit yelling, they're not your boots now." Only one of the political prisoners spoke up, "Look, what are you up to? How can he manage in bare feet?" One of the thieves took off his pumps and threw them at me. Tilde. Similar things happened to Gorbatov on several other occasions. Once, buying a tin of fish from a trustee, he had his money stolen, together with letters and photographs of his wife, by criminals who refused to return even the latter. When he opened the tin, it was full of sand. He was surprised to see that the guards did nothing to discourage this sort of thing. At the Maldyak Goldfield camp in the Magadan area, where he served his sentence, there were 400 politicals and 50 common criminals. The latter had all the privileges and in one way or another did the politicals out of much of their meager food ration. Work at the goldfield was pretty killing, particularly so considering the bad food we were given. The enemies of the people, as a rule, were detailed for the heaviest jobs, the lighter work being given to the trustees or common criminals. It was they who were appointed foremen, cooks, orderlies, and tent seniors. Naturally enough, the small amounts of fat released for the pot chiefly found their way into the bellies of the trustees. There were three types of rations, one for those who had not fulfilled their quota, another for those who had, and a third for those who had exceeded their quota. The latter automatically included the trustees. They did little enough work, but the tally clerks were of their persuasion and so they swindled, putting to their own and their mates' credit the work that we had done. As a result, the criminals fed well and the politicals went hungry. Outside the camps proper, that is, in the transit camps and stations, the criminals continued to be almost completely out of control. One of their customs was to gamble with one another for the clothes of some strange political. The loser then had to pull them off the victim and hand them over to the winner. This game was also played for prisoners' lives. A Hungarian who was in Vorkuta in 1950-1951 reports it played by 15-year-old juvenile criminals, the loser then knifing the chosen victim. These young delinquents, usually aged from 14 to 16, were seldom seen in the usual camps, being held in special centers. They were far more terrifying than any other element in Soviet society. Their egos were completely unsocialized. Killing meant nothing at all to them. They formed the hard core of the hooligan youth element which still persists in the Soviet Union and, politically speaking, may be thought to form the potential storm troops, on one side or another, in any future upsets in the country. Gorbatov mentions a criminal with fingers missing who explained to him that he had lost a political's clothes to another criminal, and before he could steal them to hand them over, the political had been transferred. So he was at once tried for negligence by his mates and sentenced to the loss of his fingers. The criminal prosecutor demanded all five, but the court settled for three. "We also have our laws," the victim commented. In another case, one who, in a mass rape aboard the convict ship Magadan, had taken a woman the leader of his band had marked down, had his eyes put out with a needle. Another leader, also on a convict ship, had gambled his brigade's bread ration away at cards. He was tried and cut to pieces. In fact, the criminals, who had such names as the Laos, Hitler, and the Knout, known at the time of the purges as Erkas and later as Blatny, in the 1950s had come to call themselves those with the law, that is, their own code. One of its provisions, though the Erkas later split into two factions on the issue, was refusal to work. Since the Erka groups had sanctions just as effective as any disposed of by the camp administration, nothing could usually be done about this. One commandant is reported given the Erka's jobs in the camp which existed only on paper. As Gorbatov describes above, the criminals in effect had arrangements with the authorities to ensure that the politicals worked on their behalf as well as on their own. Women in camps. Women criminals, who formed a high percentage of all women in the camps, were in the main tough and shameless, though one prisoner mentions a woman of the criminal class who never took her knickers off even in the washroom. It was said that the tattooing on her belly was so indecent that even she was a little embarrassed by it. The criminal women referred to themselves as little violets and sneered at the politicals as little roses. But they were somewhat restrained in their attitude towards nuns. Women on the whole seem to have survived much better than men. For this reason, we have perhaps a disproportionate number of accounts of the camps from their hands. In fact, they seem to have numbered less than 10% of the total, and many of these were in the criminal group. This was enough, all the same, to account for the innumerable mixed or women's concentration camps in the north, to which Pasternak refers in Dr. Zhivago. In the mixed camps, non-criminal women were frequently mass-raped by Erkas, or had to sell themselves for bread, or to get protection from camp officials. Those who did not were given the heaviest possible tasks until they gave in. A typical story from the Baltic Quiet Sea Canal camps is of a young woman who refused to give in to an official, who thereupon assigned her to a team of ordinary criminals who the same night blindfolded her, raped her, and pulled out several gold teeth from her mouth. There was no one to whom she could complain, for the camp chief himself was known to have raped several prisoners. The guards were often brutal to them. A woman prisoner describes an attempt by a girl to evade work by hiding under the floorboards. She was attacked by the guard dogs and dragged out so violently by the guards that she was literally scalped. Serving 5 years for stealing potatoes, she was one of the 16 or 17-year-old girls frequently reported in the camps. Decent prisoners did what they could do for them. But the demoralization of their physical deterioration was intense. A man wrote of them, "I suppose there is no more horrifying sight for the normal man than a few hundred filthy, diseased-looking, shabby women. The deep-rooted romanticism of the male is outraged, registered, and they felt this keenly. All accounts agree that even the debilitating work and diet did not damp down their sexual feelings, as it did in the case of men. Hysteria was common from this cause. A French peasant woman, divorced from a Russian and unable to leave the country, got an 8-year sentence as the wife of a traitor in November 1937. She describes being marched 25 miles and then left standing in the freezing rain outside the barbed wire for 2 hours while the camp officers were being shown a film. In the labor camps, there were seldom tractors or horses, and sleds of wood were pulled by the prisoners. If the team was made up of men, 5 were harnessed, if of women, 7. A Polish journalist who served in the Bukora camps reports seeing several hundred women carrying heavy logs, and later rails for the railway. In 1937, a special camp, in the Potma log complex, was set up which contained about 7,000 wives and sisters of enemies of the people. Some, transferred to Sagada on the Kirovsk Railway, are said to have been amnestied in 1945. But most were sent to a new camp, Alder, in the Karaganda complex. Prisoners there included wives of many enemies of the people, like those of Ryutin, Svenidze, Pyatnitsky, and Kristinsky, and sisters of Gamernik, Tukhachevsky, and others. Women who had been arrested included the pregnant. The wife of a Comintern official, an invalid with curvature of the spine, was arrested in the 7th month of pregnancy, and gave birth in the Butyrka. On the transit train, having no milk at all, she filtered the fish soup through her stockings to feed the baby. Their further fate is not stated. Children were also conceived and born in the camps. The mothers were allowed to feed them, but the babies were kept separately. After a year they were removed to unknown destinations. It was explained to the mothers, "You have broken the regulations. Connections with men are not permitted. Therefore the children are ours, not yours. They belong to the security organs, and we will bring them up." One estimate in a Soviet paper is that the children of the NKVD numbered 500,000 to 1 million. There was a children's special camp near Akmolensk, which later became an ordinary camp. About 400 children lived in barracks, in 2 or 3 levels of bunks. Later they were allowed to work, tending a herd of 250 cattle, and sowing. A sad account of those in Bamlag's children's combinat is given in a recent Soviet article. While in special children's prisons in Ashgabat, the fate of 7 or 8-year-olds was hunger and cold, beatings, humiliations. In another such article, Lydia Chukovskaya tells of children born in the camps who at the age of 5 could not yet speak. Setting up camp. In general, the great expansion of the Azov period was marked by the setting up of new camps. For example, in the Archangel area, the Kargopol camp, consisting of a number of smaller camps in a radius of about 35 miles, containing in 1940 about 30,000 prisoners, was founded in 1936 by 600 prisoners who were simply put out of the train in the middle of the forest and who built their own barracks and fences. The death rate had been very heavy. The Polish and German communist prisoners had died first, followed by the national minorities from Asia. Pasternak, certainly drawing on the experiences of friends who had suffered, described in Dr. Zhivago the setting up of a new camp. "We got off the train, a snow desert. Forest in the distance. Guards with rifle muzzles pointing at us, wolf dogs. At about the same time other groups were brought up. We were spread out and formed into a big polygon all over the field, facing outward so that we shouldn't see each other. Then we were ordered down on our knees, and told to keep looking straight ahead in front on pain of death. Then the roll call, an endless, humiliating business going on for hours and hours, and all the time we were on our knees. Then we got up and the other groups were marched off in different directions, all except ours. We were told, here you are. This is your camp. An empty snowfield with a post in the middle and a notice on it saying, Gulag 92Y.N.90. That's all there was. First we broke saplings with our bare hands in the frost to get wood to build our huts with. And in the end, believe it or not, we built our own camp. We put up our prison and our stockade and our punishment cells and our watchtowers, all with our own hands. And then we began our jobs as lumberjacks." In exactly the same way, a Pole describes being marched, in rags, to a spot on the frozen tundra where there was no more than a sign, camp point number 228. The prisoners dug pits to live in and covered them with branches and earth. The food was simply raw rye flour, kneaded with water. Another prisoner describes being marched to a temporary camp which would not hold, however squeezed, more than 1/5 of the prisoners. The others were left out in the mud for several days. They began to light fires made of bits of parts of the barracks, and were charged and beaten up by the guards. Twice a day, they had 1/3 of a liter of soup, and once a day about half a kilo of bread. On entry into an established camp, prisoners were allotted their categories for work. This might be done by a quick examination of the prisoner's legs. A certificate of first-class health was required for the heaviest tasks. A Soviet writer describes one being issued to a political 4 hours before her death from scurvy, then they were marched to the barracks, where typically, 200 men slept in 50 bug-ridden bunks, on boards or mattresses full of heavy and hard-packed sawdust. Crowding was intense. The former director of the Kemerovo Works describes negotiating with the NKVD for 2,000 slave laborers. The trouble was not the number, but how to accommodate them in the existing camps in the area. The officials concerned were shown around a camp which appeared to be packed solid, but the commandant agreed with his superior that yet another layer of bunks could be put in. There would be a stove, though not adequate to warm one of the Arctic huts because the orderlies only brought in 10 pounds of coal dust for each stove, and you didn't get much warmth from that. In a corner would be the 20-gallon latrine tank which prisoner orderlies carried off to empty daily, light work for people on the sick list. The company, apart from the complement of Irkas who in a non-penal camp would be lording it in the corridors, were of a varied lot of politicals. There would be saboteurs, specialists and engineers. At first they mostly had technical jobs, but, as the mass purges grew in scope, so many engineers and specialists flooded the camps that the chance of appointment to a technical position which had previously saved so many of them became proportionately rare. There were certain special categories. In Kotlas, there was a whole group of men of 80 years and older who had been sentenced in Dagestan as part of the liquidation of feudal remnants. And about 3,000 Moscow homosexuals were in camp at the Third Watershed, on the Baltic White Sea Canal. But usually the intake was mixed. An account of the Jezkazgan camp in a Moscow article of the Khrushchev period mentions a former ambassador to China, a soloist from the Bolshoi Opera, an illiterate peasant, an Air Force general. Common were soldiers, intellectuals, and especially Ukrainian and other nationalists, on the one hand, and members of religious sects, on the other. Solzhenitsyn points out that the Baptists were in the camps simply for praying. For this, at the time he writes of, they all got 25 years, because that was how it was now. 25 years for everybody. Registered there are many reports of sectarians being beaten or sent to the isolator cells for refusal to work on Sundays. A priest, beaten blind, was noted in 1937. As in all times of trouble and oppression, the millenarian sects flourished. In the great slave empires of the past, similar voices had always spoken for the oppressed and hopeless. Now they sometimes preached that the horrors of the present were a special trial, and that from the Russian people, degraded and demoralized, a race of saints would arise. Even 20 years later, in Vorkuta, we are told that there was more religious organization, and sharper national feeling, among the minority groups still settled there after their camp experiences than in other districts. Prisoners' rights were virtually limited to making written protests and complaints. The result, either there was nothing or it was rejected. Such applicants made a prisoner unpopular with the authorities. In the penal camps proper, however, there was considerable freedom of speech. Somebody in the room was yelling, "You think that old bastard in Moscow with the mustache is going to have mercy on you? He wouldn't give a damn about his own brother, never mind slobs like you. The great thing about a penal camp was you had a hell of a lot of freedom. Back in Ustyuzma if you said they couldn't get matches outside they put you in the can and slapped on another 10 years. But here you could yell your head off about anything you liked and the squealers didn't even bother to tell on you. The security fellows couldn't care less. The only trouble was you didn't have much time to talk about anything." Almost every account quotes cases of people who remained devoted to the party and the government and attributed their arrest to error. These bored and annoyed the other prisoners considerably. In some cases, though not in all, they turned informer. There were, in any case, a number of these by common NKVD practice. Informers who were recognized as such were always killed sooner or later. If the NKVD had been unable to extricate them in time, it made no complaint about their deaths. Herling gives an account of a revenge taken on a notorious former NKVD interrogator who was recognized in the camp, and when badly beaten up, but not killed, complained to the guards, who did nothing to save him so that he was finally killed a month later after endless persecution and attempts to appeal. Behind the wire. Reveille is usually reported as at 5 a.m. a hammer pounding on a rail outside camp headquarters. Anyone caught a few minutes late getting up could be sentenced on the spot to a few days in the isolator. In the winter, it would still be dark. Searchlights would be crisscrossing over the compound from the watchtowers at the far corners. Apart from the guards and the barbed wire, most camps also relied on dogs, their long chains fastened by a ring to a wire running from watchtower to watchtower. The noise of the ring screeching along the wire was a continual background. The prisoner's first thought, all day, was of food, and it is now that the breakfast, the best meal of the day, was served. We will consider food, the center of the entire norm system and the key to Stalin's plans for efficient slave labor, later. Then they were assembled and marched off to work, in gangs of 20.